This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Engagement on Thursday, April 17th.
The Pavilion Royale is wheelchair accessible and is located at 5800 Airline Drive.
This is Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
Explore a world of entertainment April 19th, 20th, 27th, and 28th at the Houston International Festival, spotlighting Out of Africa in downtown. Make the Out of Africa Zone your first stop. Visit a reproduction of one of the eight wonders of the world, the mountain-carved Church of Lalibela. Check out the North American debut of the National Dance Theater of Ethiopia on the WAMU Center stage. And, of course, don't miss the World Music Stage featuring top artists like Buddy Guy, the Neville Brothers, Habib Koit, the Wailers, and Taj Mahal. Get early bird tickets till April 16th at any Houston area HEB location or online at ifest.org or at the gate. Come downtown to the Houston International Festival, brought to you by KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Valinsky.
I'm Brian Erickson.
And I'm Glenn Holt. And on the show tonight, we have somebody, I guess, from the Houston Pride Band, who will be talking about the free concert in the park for kids and their families that will be coming up April 12th and their plans for the big June 2008 anniversary celebration. In our second hour, Joan Devlin will speak with Jessica Valenti, author of Full Frontal Feminism, which sounds interesting. And we also have an announcement about Eric Himmen and Tom Goss. We'll have some of their music and an announcement about a performance that they will be doing. And, of course, we have This Way Out, starting with News Wrap.
I'm Erica Springer.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending March 29th, 2008. 30 men have been arrested in a so-called morals raid on a private home in the Iranian city of Esfahan. Citing sources within Iran, Human Rights Watch said this week that the men have been held since late February without access to lawyers and without being formally charged. They're reportedly accused of consensual homosexual conduct and drinking alcohol. According to Human Rights Watch, police forced the men to undergo forensic medical examinations to look for evidence that they've engaged in homosexual acts. It wasn't the first such raid in the Islamic Republic. Police invaded another private party in an apartment building, also in Esfahan, during a nationwide morality crackdown in May 2007. They arrested 87 people, mostly men, 24 of whom were tried for facilitating immorality and sexual misconduct. A court found all of them guilty in June 2007, sentencing most to as many as 80 lashes and fines equivalent to $5,000. Those verdicts are under appeal and have not yet been enforced. Citing its unnamed sources in Iran, Human Rights Watch said that police have intensified surveillance and harassment of people connected to those May 2007 arrests. Several men described being detained and interrogated by police who demanded the names of their associates. Iranian law punishes consensual, penetrative, same-gender sex between men with death and non-penetrative activity with up to 100 lashes. Lesbian sexual conduct is punishable by lashings and death on the fourth conviction. Last September, Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad infamously declared during a speech at Columbia University in New York City that there were no homosexuals in his country.
But elsewhere in the Middle East, the Israeli government has granted a Palestinian man provisional permission to move from the occupied West Bank to Tel Aviv so that he can be reunited with his gay partner. Palestinians in the occupied territories are rarely granted permission to live with their Israeli partners, regardless of sexuality. Peter Lerner, a spokesperson for the Israeli military in the West Bank, told reporters that the Palestinian man's lawyer convinced them that he received death threats from fellow Palestinians after his sexual orientation was discovered. Another reason for granting the temporary permit was reportedly the health of the Israeli partner, who suffers from heart disease. Citing privacy concerns, Lerner didn't give the men's names, but said that the two have been in a relationship for about 8 years. The Palestinian man's permit must be renewed every month until the Interior Ministry makes a final decision about his application for permanent residence under family reunification laws.
Cuban lawmakers will vote in June on a bill that would make the country one of the world's most progressive for LGBT civil rights. Draft legislation introduced this week would make it illegal to discriminate in jobs and housing based on sexual orientation or gender identity. It would recognize same-gender domestic partnerships, but not grant marriage or adoption rights. The measure would also allow transsexuals to have identity cards showing the gender with which they identify, and require the government health service to pay for sex reassignment surgery. The legislation has been championed by Mariela Castro, the daughter of Cuban President Raul Castro, and the niece of former leader Fidel. Mariela heads the government-funded National Center for Sex Education and has been a longtime LGBT rights advocate. The bill's introduction represents rapid, almost head-spinning progress for the island's LGBT people. Gays and lesbians long struggled for identity under the five-decade rule of Fidel Castro. There are no gay clubs in Havana, although one bar does offer a weekly gay night. Gay men were regularly rounded up and jailed under Fidel's predecessor, Fulgencio Batista. But after the communist revolution, many were sent to forced labor camps for so-called re-education and rehabilitation. In another sign of social change under Raul Castro, the country ended restrictions on the general public's use of cell phones this week, previously allowed only to foreigners and government officials, although most Cubans still can't afford them.
302 couples have taken advantage of Mexico City's civil union law since it came into force in March 2007, according to recently released government statistics. Unions have been registered in 15 of the city's 16 boroughs, and some 94% of them were by gays and lesbians. The law allows same-gender and heterosexual couples, as well as two friends, roommates, or extended family members, to register their relationship and gain spousal rights in areas such as inheritance, pensions, property, co-parenting, and medical decisions. Only one couple has dissolved a civil union, and one union ended when a partner died. The northern state of Coahuila, which borders Texas, is the only other locale in Mexico with a civil union law.
In 1998, Ecuador became the first nation in the Americas to adopt constitutional language banning discrimination based on sexual orientation. But former model and television news anchor Rosana Quiarolo, who won election to the South American country's National Assembly on a platform of environmental protection, has caused widespread controversy by embracing the country's ultra-conservative Christian evangelical movement and urging changes to those constitutional protections. She asked her colleagues to change wording in the Constitution referring to sexual orientation to preference, because orientation, she said, could also be applied to pedophiles and other degenerates. Expanding on her remarks during a March 25th interview with El Universo newspaper, she said that the word orientation leaves the door open to pedophiles, to bestiality. Several members of her own party have condemned Chiarolo's remarks. Fernando Cordero, vice president of the assembly, told the newspaper that those who promote this debate seek to tarnish the name of the assembly to divide assembly members and the Ecuadorian people.
The leader of a Nigerian queer rights group was violently attacked this week while attending a funeral. The unnamed leader is the director of the Port Harcourt chapter of Changing Attitude Nigeria, the African nation's leading LGBT advocacy group. According to their press release, the activist said he was approached by a man who asked to speak with him away from the service. He said he complied and was then brutally beaten and kicked by a group of six men. I thought they were going to kill me there and then, he said. They were shouting, "You notorious homosexual, you think you can run away from us for your notorious group to cause more abomination in our land?" The attackers also threatened to kill other members of Changing Attitude Nigeria for inducting young people. "I suspect an insider or one of the leaders of our Anglican church have hands in this," the man said in the press release. He also charged the Church of Nigeria with inciting violence, including the country's notoriously anti-queer Archbishop Peter Akinola, who also presides over the traditionalist Global South Anglican Steering Committee. Those Anglican leaders, based primarily in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, have threatened to leave the Global Christian Consortium because its North American regions, including the U.S. Episcopal Church, have adopted progressive positions on the inclusion of LGBT people in the church.
Despite last week's dire warning from Polish President Lech Kaczynski that supporting the proposed European Union Charter of Fundamental Rights would open the door to same-gender marriage in a devoutly Catholic country, his citizens apparently don't believe him. 69%, according to a poll published by the daily newspaper Gazeta Wyborcza. Moreover, 65% want Poland to endorse the charter, while only 15% were against it. The notoriously homophobic Kaczynski used footage of two New York gay men getting married in Canada in his nationally televised speech to claim that the charter would affect the accepted moral order in Poland.
In the U.S., Peter Sprigg, vice president of policy at the notoriously right-wing Family Research Council, this week sent a letter to the LGBT advocacy group Immigration Equality, apologizing for his recent comments suggesting that lesbian, gay Americans should be exiled. "I used language that did not communicate respect for the essential dignity of every human being as a person created in the image of God," Sprigg wrote. "I apologize for speaking in a way that did not reflect the standards which the Family Research Council and I embrace."
Members of the Oklahoma City chapter of Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, or PFLAG, met with Republican state legislator Sally Kern this week to express concern over her recent homophobic comments, including the assertion that gays are the biggest threat our nation has, even more so than terrorism. Kern maintained her refusal to apologize during the meeting, according to a PFLAG statement, but did seem to support workplace anti-discrimination protections based on sexual orientation. PFLAG says it believes the meeting was the beginning of a dialogue. It was Kern's first ever with a group working for LGBT equality.
And finally, it really wasn't much of a secret, but frontman Michael Stipe of the popular rock group REM officially came out in a March 18th interview with Spin magazine. "It was super complicated for me in the 80s, he said. I was totally open with the band and my family and my friends, and certainly the people I was sleeping with. I thought it was pretty obvious. Now, Stipe says, I recognize that for public figures to be very open about their sexuality helps some kid somewhere."
That's News Wrap for the week ending March 29th, 2008. Written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Erica Springer.
This is Queer Voices. Well, we're going to go way back into the archives now to replay an interview that Joan Devlin did with James T. Sears, author of Queer Voices in the South. And this was done way back in October of 2001.
And I'm in the studio with
J.D. Doyle.
And
I'm here, too, in the shadows.
Jack Walensky. And we're talking to James T. Sears, who is the author of Rebels, Ruby Fruit, and Rhinestones, Queering Space in the Stonewall South, which is the second volume in his absolutely fantastic gay history series on queer issues in the South. And this one, what made this one so much fun to read, is that it covers quite a bit of ground in Houston. Mm-hmm. So what made you decide to choose Houston, you know, in the mix?
Well, again, this period of time that this book covers is primarily from Stonewall to the first march on Washington in 1979. And during that period of time, during that 10-year period of time, Houston and Atlanta were really the two cities that had the most influence in the quote-unquote gay rights movement in the South. And in fact, as some of your readers, I'm sure, and listeners would recognize, by the end of the 70s, the major national newspapers and magazines was calling Houston the San Francisco of the South.
And did you have much trouble tracking down Houston's history?
Yes and no. One of the things that, again, that Houston has that many cities do not have at the time I was doing this was an archives. Right now, in fact, Houston has two archives, which is really important because for too long, when we talk about history or we read history or we learn history in school, we don't learn about people's history. We learn about history of the great events or great people, which often are white and male. Okay. And we certainly don't learn about our rainbow history. And the only way that we can tell our stories and tell our stories to the next generation is by maintaining and collecting those bits of memories of our communities. And that's in newsletters, those are in love poems, those are in photographs, those are in all different kinds of everyday life. And luckily, much of that was in Houston for this period of time that this book covers.
How had queer history changed in the era before and then after Stonewall?
The book that preceded this was called, or is called, Lonely Hunters. And that period of time covers basically from the early 50s through the late 60s. During that period of time in Houston, although there were, for example, a number of quote, queer bars, etc., but oftentimes in places throughout the South, the space that you had if you were homosexual and living in the South in the 50s and 60s was a space that was really on the edges of the communities and of the cultures. So, for example, if you would go to a city, you know, any large city, or whether it be in Raleigh or in Tampa, and you were looking to meet other men, for example, then you would go to a bar. But how can you find a bar when there's not a Dameron's Guide? Well, one place you would go would be to the nicest hotel in that city, whether it's Thomas Jefferson Hotel in Raleigh, and at that hotel bar would likely be the place where you'd find some people who are homosexual. And again, that would just be by a wink and a nod. Mm-hmm. What happened during this period of time from the late, from the mid-60s into the 70s, you really have a number of activists who came out of the anti-war movement, the feminist movement, the hippie movements, etc., and they brought their activism to organize in gay issues. And so this book really talks about the emergence of communities in the South and communities in Houston, and how space became queered in a lot of other places, from softball fields to MCC churches to Radical Fairy gatherings to leather motorcycle clubs like the Texas Wranglers, etc.
Is there a Southern gay sensibility?
That's almost redundant. I think there is a gay sensibility, and I think a lot of that is also Southern. One good example that I think is one aspect of queer communities is the drag culture, and part of that is clearly, you know, is really rooted in the South. If by Southern sensibility or Southern gay sensibility you mean being different than, let's say, Northern sensibility, absolutely. One of the problems that individuals had who were organizing in the South, who were doing it less effective, let's say, than people like Rita Wanstrom, I think really the grandmother of the gay rights movement, quote-unquote, here in Houston. One of the problems that some organizers had is that they did not have Southern sensibility. So they approached organizing in places like Richmond, Virginia, the same way that one were organized, for example, in Rochester, New York. Mm-hmm. Well, we know that that how people get together as Southerners is sometimes very differently than how people get together in the North. So, for example, the whole notion of being social is much more important, I think, for Southerners than for other people outside the South. And so, when individuals and groups were organizing, for example, in Houston, one of the groups that was organizing were, you know, women's groups. And they, for example, I talk about the Milam House here, the National Organization of Women's Chapter, and also groups like the Lesberadas. Those groups, like the Lesberadas, they had softball teams, they had potlucks, they had lots of different newsletters, lots of activities that on the surface we say, oh, that's not political, that's not doing anything. But actually, that was quite political, but it was political because it brought together people.
It's a community.
It is a community, and when you bring together people and people who are queer, whether they're for a poetry reading or whether they're there for a motorcycle run or they're there for a drag pageant or they're there for an MCC congregation, then you are in fact creating communities. And that's what this book is about, is the emergence of different communities from Houston to Lexington, Kentucky, to Lubbock, Texas, to Norfolk, Virginia.
And a community is not a city. A community is different parts of a city.
Yeah, and in fact, I talk about this a lot in the book, and I think Joan captures that also in the review that she that appeared in the Texas Triangle, and that is simply that when some people speak of the, quote, gay community, in 1970s, the gay community of Houston or the gay community of Atlanta, you know, really they were misspeaking, because they were really talking about perhaps what their vision as a small group of what this larger locality of people who were queer living in Atlanta was about. But in fact, those communities in Atlanta were groups of people who were grouped together based upon interest. So, for example, you had the Atlanta Lesbian Feminist Alliance. There you had, again, different groups like the Closet, the political groups publishing The Closet Door. And only occasionally would those groups intersect. A good example of the intersection here is in Houston, where you had the emergence of the Gay Political Caucus, and which eventually developed into the election of Kathy Whitmire as controller, and the unseating of Frank Mann. That was done through a series of alliances by people such as Pokey Anderson and many other people who cut across these different communities of differences. But sometimes when we talk about the gay community, we talk about the gay community in the sense of being monolithic. And also in terms of if the gay community is and has a, also should have an agenda. Well, whose agenda? So I think one of the lessons I hope that people learn from reading Rebels, Fruit, and Rhinestones is that we are a rainbow community with lots of different interests and lots of different backgrounds and positions and philosophies. And what we need to do, the lessons of success and effectiveness, is when we honor those different voices, the voices of Les Baradas, the voices of the Stuck softball teams, all these different kinds of voices, the voices of drag, etc. And the process of doing that, we become a stronger community, not a weaker community, per se.
Prior to Anita Bryant, was there much networking between the cities in the mm-hmm. South?
There was, as early as 1972, and I talk about this in the book, of course, there was a convention of, quote, gay Southern militants that was held in Athens, Georgia. 3 years later, or 4 years later, in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, was the first gathering of what was later to be called the Southeastern Gay and Lesbian Coalition. 75. And those groupings of 3 or 4 days brought together, you know, several hundred people who were organizing from all over the Southeast. And that was those kinds of conferences or conventions were incredibly important, because it enabled people to communicate with one another across different localities. So not only people who were involved as lesbian feminists, for example, in Atlanta and Houston, but also people who were lesbian feminists and people who were radical fairies, etc. And so those kinds of organizational times were very important. But again, prior to Anita Bryant, all these individuals, we're talking about, you know, several hundred people in the South by 75, 76 who were, quote, activists, that was a minuscule amount of people compared to those people, for example, who would go party at the old plantation, for example, or go discoing in the Glitter Gulch in Raleigh, or go to the be involved in one of the gay crews in New Orleans and Mobile. Most of the, quote, queer community was outside of any of this activism. And what Anita Bryant and the referendum in Dade County did was to present an opportunity for those activists to, in fact, engage a larger group of people in organizing.
It mainstreamed the community.
It mainstreamed the community, and also it allowed if Stonewall was the match that started the modern gay liberation movement, then, in fact, Anita Bryant was really the wildfire that spread across the entire country, starting from the Southeast, that engaged and enraged thousands of persons. And in fact, after the defeat of the Dade County referendum in June of 1977, Anita Bryant was already scheduled for a variety of different Christian bookings where she would sing and et cetera. She first went to Norfolk. And when she went to Norfolk, there were hundreds of people outside the Scope Auditorium protesting. And inside, there were 100 people who were protesting. She immediately went from Norfolk to Houston, Texas, where there were hundreds and thousands of people who marched. And I talk about that march to the government offices and to protest her. And that was really the first time in all these different locations, wherever Anita Bryant went, she was met with a phalanx of different communities. Who were differences, who were all protesting the policies that she was promulgating. And so Anita Bryant and the Dade County Ordinance was really probably the singular most important organizing tool that activists had, and also was the very first time that we began to talk in this country, and particularly in the South, about homosexuality.
And even after she left the city, it left a structure, at least to build on, for that gay community.
Absolutely. And in some communities, for example, in New Orleans, there were community organizations that were developed because of that march, and then that those community organizations continued. But if you can imagine, in small places like Tyler, Texas, for example, or Tupelo, Mississippi, where homosexuality was never discussed. All of a sudden now, you would be watching one of your three, and there were at that time generally only three TV stations, mm-hmm. and Walter Cronkite would come on and talk about homosexuals, and Anita Bryant. You would turn on, if you did have a PBS station, McNeil Lehr Report, and there would be a debate between people like Anita Bryant and Bob Kuntz. You would pick up your Montgomery newspaper, and the headlines would be, something about Anita Bryant, or there would be letters to the editor, or there would even be polls. What do Montgomery citizens think about homosexuals being allowed to teach, or homosexuals being fired if they were known to be gay? That was unheard of prior to that. And so Anita Bryant was really a critical moment for the community. And one last thing that I'll stop is, it also, I think, reflected the splintering of the quote gay community along these lines that I talk about, for example, lines of race and gender and class, because by and large, the Anita Bryant campaign was run in a way that really in many ways disempowered Latinos and Hispanics who were organizing, trying to organize in places like Hialeah, and also the depiction even of Anita Bryant herself. There's one famous picture of her in The Advocate, and she's painted as a cow, and you have an orange that's sort of up her butt. This notion of Anita Bryant as sort of the Antichrist really sort of missed the point, and almost became misogynistic, as opposed to understanding that Anita Bryant really was a reflection of forces of darkness, the forces of the radical right, which was really using Anita Bryant just as her husband Bob Green used Anita Bryant for other purposes.
The other thing is, what would you say was the most defining characteristic of our community back in the days between Stonewall and HIV?
Okay, and by our community, you mean the...
I mean the GLBT community overall. I mean, who were we then? What were our issues? What were our goals?
Well, again, as I think I've sort of described a little bit, we had lots of different goals. And for many people who were even coming out during this period of time, again, we're talking about a period of time where there truly was an era of sexual liberation. The issues of drugs and drug enforcement was very different 30 years ago. And so for many people, again, who were gay and lesbian or bisexual, it meant simply an opportunity where queer space was more public. So, for example, if you would go to a bar or a club, you wouldn't, there would actually be signs, for those clubs. You wouldn't have to go in the back door, for example. And that was liberating. You would go, clubs, towns from Lexington, Kentucky, or from Louisville, where people could disco all night, or you could go to the Plantation or the Bayou Landing and go to Sense Around, and dance with hundreds and hundreds of people. That was a defining, different kind of period of time than just 10 years earlier. And that is an element of the, quote, queer community that was part of the 70s. And beyond that, though, were many other individuals, who really still remained invisible. And I talk about in the book African Americans, for example, and some of them living in small towns, as well as those people, where there would be no bars per se, but they would go to nip joints, for example, or also the underside of that, and that is in some bars like the old plantation. If you were a person of color, you'd often be asked for multiple IDs, or in places like Columbia, South Carolina, when there got to be too many women or too many people of color, all of a sudden the dancers found that we went from disco to country and western because they wanted to clear out groups of people.
Mm-hmm. We are talking to James T. Sears. He is the author of Rebels, Ruby Fruit, and Rhinestones, Queering Space in the Stonewall South, which covers much of Houston's history among that of other cities. And I guess my next question for you is, I noticed that in some cases you picked up where Lonely Hunters left off. You actually talked to some people that you had been speaking with in Lonely Hunters and covered some of the cities. And then in the case of, for instance, Houston, you kind of picked up a whole new city. How do you decide, which southern cities and which groups to kind of include?
Well, what I tried to do in Rebels, River, and Rhinestones, because there was much more material that allowed me the luxury of selection, Lonely Hunters was a little bit more difficult because there was less material available, just like the next book I work on in the 30s and 40s, there's less material. So by the one way that I selected cities and communities was trying to look for diversity. So that we simply did not just focus on Texas or focus on Virginia, for example. But the other is to look at what areas seem to have had an emergence of communities. And one of the, I think a person who reads or studies the book will come to a realization that really there were different periods of tides where different communities of different sizes began to emerge in a more openly gay or queer way during the 70s. So, for example, Atlanta, Georgia, in 1971 was the first state or first city to have a gay pride march, followed by Dallas in 72. Well, there were no gay pride marches at all, for the entire decade in any city in South Carolina. Or in Norfolk, Virginia, for example, that community really began to organize, not until about 1976 or 77. So, in selecting communities, what I tried to do is not only select those communities that were influential at a particular period of time, but also by selecting a variety of communities, making sure that there is diversity there that reflected the different kinds of ebbs and flow that takes place in any kinds of organizing.
How difficult was it for you to find people willing to participate in your effort?
Most people were very willing to participate, and the way I work basically is it's not just stick a microphone in someone's mouth and say, here are the five questions and thank you, ma'am, and move on to someone else. I like to develop relationships with people I talk to, and many of those people I've become very good friends. And in the process of doing that, that I think allows me to be able to get to know those individuals, to be able to portray those people as human beings, not simply as someone on like Leonard Maklovich on the cover of Time magazine. So you get a sense for who they are. So I think that's one aspect of the.
And what have they taught you as you've been going along?
I think one of the most important lessons I've learned is that individuals make a difference. And secondly, that activism takes many shades. All of us do not need to be activists marching down or marching on at Montrose and Westheimer, but all of us have an ethical and social responsibility to act in an ethical and socially responsible way. And for some individuals, that's writing. For some individuals, that's simply disclosing his or her sexual orientation to a family member or family members. All those little acts all add up, like drops in a bucket, and that bucket eventually overflows with water. And that's precisely what happened in the 1970s. Individuals made a difference. And some people who looks at Rebels Revolution and writes as well, says, there's too many people I talk about, or I don't recognize any of those people. Well, that's because what little gay history we have is primarily history from the West Coast and East Coast, and it also is the same kind of history that we were taught in school, that is history of several important people. And although people like Elaine Noble and Leonard Maklovich and other individuals made a difference, they were just some of the individuals that were contributing to the communities. And so people, as you mentioned, like Rita Wonstrom or Polke Anderson, the women that organized Point Blank Times, or if we go to Atlanta, people like Vicki Gabriner and Lorraine Hutchins, or in Norfolk, people like J.D. and J.R. and Marge Clearwater. All these are individuals that run into people's minds only if they don't appreciate that we're talking about individuals, each of whom made a decision that they were going to act. And those collective actions is what brought about the emergence of communities in the South.
The other thing I liked is that you talked about things like, things that are pretty much from the times, like trying to start an all-gay commune. Mm. Different the way our movement, as always.
Radical fairies.
Right. As always, we interacted with other timely activist movements. It wasn't just about, GLBT issues. Lesbians also worked toward, passage of the Equal Rights Amendment. Mm-hmm. You had a Back to Nature movement that gay people were a big part of. You had an anti-war movement that gay people were a big part of. Was that something you were kind of expecting when you started out? How close did the information you received mirror what your expectations were?
Well, again, I don't think I was had any expectation because, there's very little out there in terms of books and articles about Southern queer history. Again, what we're basically presented with is the histories outside the South. One of the things I was surprised about was that within a period of time of Stonewall, within about a year and year and a half, that there were the number of gay liberation fronts that existed in odd places like New Orleans, for example, which those of us that are familiar with New Orleans gay history knows that it's anything but an activist organized community. It's or places like Louisville or Lexington, as well as places like Houston in terms of organizing on campuses. Those groups that were organizing cut across all different kinds of cities, college cities. And in fact, the only conference that the Gay Liberation Front ever had was actually held in Austin, Texas. But that was the first wave of activism. And what happened after about 72, 73, you then have a beginning of another group emerging of individuals who are a little bit more mainstream in their thinking and in their organization. And I think that group of people made it possible for these other communities to emerge. And so I guess that's what I was surprised by, was not only the amount of activism that existed on college campuses and outside of college campuses, but if you just think about, like, in Houston, Texas, 5 years before that, when you had a bar raid, and I talk about the bar raid of the Roaring Sixties, for example, there's one person, Rita Wonstrom, who said, we're not going to have this anymore. And she formed a group called the Tumblebugs, a group of women who, along with Percy Foreman and Ray Hill and other people, actually took the city to court for that. Well, there were, within a decade, there were literally dozens of Rita Wonstroms. And I think that is the surprising part to me, is how quickly we went from dozens of people to hundreds of people. And the book starts in Stonewall and ends in the March in Washington. And in the chapter that talk about the March in Washington, many of the people that you read about in the book are in fact in Washington in that October chilly day. And there, even the parade itself, where Texas, for example, had the largest delegation, largest set of marches for anybody in the South. You had the Houston marching band there. But each group represented in the march represented our diversity. And so you had women and people of color leading the march. And then you had different groups, as I said, like the Radical Fairies, the RFD, the motorcycle groups. All these groups were marching. And that, to me, is really symbolic of our movement. And to the degree that we ever want to approach ourselves with having a gay agenda, then I think that what we do is we betray that diversity that one finds in the March on Washington 1979, because it's through diversity that we have strength.
Well, the other interesting thing is that we're so spoiled today with email and everything that flashes around the world very quickly. Back then, we didn't have that type of communication. I mean, and some of the things you talk about in your book is that these parallels that happen in these different cities that are very isolated. I mean, even the Advocate, when you finally got the Advocate, you know, and I'm talking about the 80s, and you're talking about the 60s and 70s, when, you know, that news didn't get around that quickly.
That's absolutely correct. But, you know, you did have many small newsletters, and also, you know, women and men, you know, communicated not generally by telephone, but oftentimes either by traveling through these conferences, like I mentioned, as well as through letters. You had small publications like Nuntius, for example, in Houston. You had the emergence of Integrity Houston in the early 70s. When people started to engage in activities, they also then began to network with other individuals. And it's that network and sharing of information, although slower than what we'd expect today, which really had a really profound influence. You mentioned the Advocate, and of course the Advocate was originally called the Los Angeles Advocate. It's a city paper. And one of the things you asked earlier, Joan, about what some things I was surprised about when I was doing researching of the book. One of the things I'm really surprised about was the disproportionate number of women and men who were activists throughout the country who come from the South. And one example, the reason I thought about that, because you mentioned the Advocate, really the other main magazine at the time was a magazine called Gay, G-A-Y, out of New York. And that was edited by two Southerners, a Southerner from Hindman, Kentucky, Large Clark, and his lover, Jack Nichols. But if you look at the enormous emergence, for example, of lesbian writing, okay, publishing houses, Daughters, Inc., Daughters, Inc. was a major publishing. It published Ruby Fruit Jungle, also written by a Southerner. Daughters, Inc. was located in New England, but is actually founded by two women, one Park Bowman and the other June Arnold, one from Houston, one from South Carolina. Look at women's music. People like Mae Christian, just to name one individual. Many of these individuals who had gained national reputation, come from the South. Leonard Maklovich is another example of someone. And so I think one of the lessons that we have to have as learn hopefully as Southerners is that not only is it a myth of Stonewall that nothing happened before 1969 in organizing, including the South, which it did, but also that Southerners didn't matter. You know, we could have lost the war between the states, and the gay rights movement would have been the same. It would not have been the same, because Southerners both in the South and Southern expatriates outside the South really made the difference, and that's why I try to chronicle in this book.
From a different perspective, if you did these books on the Northeast or the West Coast, you think you'd get the same lessons?
I think there would be some parallels. I think, for example, what was just mentioned in terms of the difficulties of communication, the multiplicity of communities. I think that would be the a commonality. I think there would be differences, and I think those differences are partly rooted upon culture. I do think that, particularly in, we're talking about the period 1970s, that this is the emergence of the new Sunbelt South. This is the emergence of the sort of the Nixonian Republican agenda for the South. You know, the South was still a very different culture and region and communities than, for example, what you found in the Northwest or the West Coast or New England. Most books that are written on history really do focus either on a city, like Chauncey's book in New York City, or on a community, for example, like a Fire Island. There's really nothing that's parallel to this with respect to focusing on regions.
When you hear about the Madison Society, that's New York, Chicago, you know,
well,
are limited.
Well, but, you know, but even the Mattachine Society, and the Mattachine Society was the first organization that really took off, that was formed in 1951 by leftist communist Harry Hay. You know, there were chapters, there were Mattachine chapters in the South in the 60s, including Florida. There were people organizing in Jackson, Mississippi through Mattachine. People are organizing through Mattachine in Austin. There were also the counterpart to Mattachine Society in the 50s and 60s was something called The Ladder, which was a lesbian magazine organization, and they also had chapters. And there were Daughters of Bilitis chapters in southern cities, like Dallas
networked.
And New Orleans.
And they networked.
Yes, to a certain degree. I mean, because they got comments out of mailings, they got the magazine, The Ladder. They attended conferences, or some of them attended conferences.
What's the response been to the book so far?
I think it's, for me, it's a little bit too early to tell. I think that part of the response here is people are surprised that there is so much that was happening in the South. And I think, again, part of that surprise is because we have been, I think, misled to believe that nothing of any importance ever happens in the South. I think the other surprising part to me is when people begin to read these stories, that they actually find relevance to some of the issues that we're facing today. And let me give you one example. In the beginning of the 70s, we were talking about the Gay Liberation Front. And what was really important there was not, was really human sexual liberation. Many people were fighting for. By the end of the 70s, the agenda had changed. The agenda had changed to more legislative changes, including in Houston, for example, the Gay Political Caucus, in terms of the election of Kathy Whitmire as controller, and later on with the referendum that went down in defeat. This movement from being separate from society and saying that we are different and that what we ought to be talking about is sexual liberation, to we want a place at the table of society is I think a parallel set of concerns that you find again today. Those individuals who see themselves again as more assimilating into society, and those people seeing themselves as more separating from society. So you have, for example, one individual who was a Stonewall veteran in 1979, I quote him, said, you know, when I marched and rioted in 1969 in New York City at Christopher Street, you know, I was not rioting, you know, so that we would have, you know, Olivia Cruz's and 10 leather bars. You know, I was rioting for other reasons, okay? And by the 70s, there was a commodification of homosexuality. And the commodification was very clear. I mean, for example, you had gay bald dolls. You had the village people. That type of assimilation and the tension between assimilation and radical differences from the mainstream society is something I think that people need to be aware of, because that has been present in each generation that organizes on behalf of or for something called the queer communities.
And how can people get your book?
Copies, I believe, are available in different bookstores. I was just, for example, at Crossroads. There's another bookstore in town, among others. You know, local bookstores, Lobo. They're also available at the main, you know, the large corporate bookstores, Barnes Noble, to name others. You can also get it online, for example, Amazon.com. I think it's on the top 25 list of the Amazon.com gay list. So those are several places.
Great. And again, the title of the book is Rebels, Ruby Fruit, and Rhinestones, Queering Space in the Stonewall South. It is by author James T. Sears. And you are listening to Lesbian and Gay Voices.
Well, actually, you're listening to Queer Voices. That was from the Queer Voices Archive, October of 2001. Joan Devlin will be back at the top of the hour interviewing Jessica Valenti, the author of Full Frontal Feminism. This is Queer Voices. Coming up next, Brian interviews Rudolph Martinez from the Houston Pride Band. And to lead us into that, here's a sample of the Houston Pride Band. Thank you. Here's a sample of what the Houston Pride Band sounds like. And now here is Brian.
Thank you, Glenn. Tonight in the studio we have Rudy Martinez in. He's going to tell us about some of the upcoming events for the Houston Pride Band. And especially if you're out there in our listening audience and you were ever a part of the Lone Star Symphonic Band or the Montrose Symphonic Band or even way back when to the Montrose Marching Band, you might want to listen up because we're going to be giving a call for to come to arms with bringing your instruments for a reunion coming up in June. But first we want to talk to Rudy and hear a little bit about what's coming on in the coming up in the month of April.
Yeah, thank you. The Houston Pride Band is part of their 2007-2008 season of celebration is celebrating families with a free children's concert on Saturday, April 12th at 1 p.m. at Spots Park, and that's at 401 South Heights Boulevard.
What kind of pieces are they going to be playing here?
We're going to be taking samples of previous pieces that we played in the past, as well as some pieces of what we will be playing for the 30th anniversary concert, so it's going to be a little of everything.
Is the music, in fact, like the selections, are they going to be more aimed towards the younger listening audience or just giving them some exposure, period?
Exactly. The whole intent is to be a fun and whimsical introduction to the world of concert music. So it's going to be bits and pieces. And the concert's only going to last about 30 minutes because we've got to be sure we keep the little ones' interest.
They have a very short attention span.
Definitely.
Yeah. I have a couple nieces. They'd probably love to be there. What else will be going on for the kids that day?
Well, the great thing about that day is right after the concert, we're going to have an instrument petting zoo where the children can actually have the opportunity to meet the Houston Pride Band members and actually see their instruments up close and get a feel for, like, the clarinet, the trumpet, the trombone, just get a real interactive experience for them.
Does this mean I should bring my llama down there?
You know, llamas are all appreciated.
Well, in fact, what kind of pets are going to be out there that day? Do you have any idea?
I'm not exactly sure if we're going to have pets out there. Now, this is provided in conjunction with the Houston Gay and Lesbian Parents and their annual Grassy Hill Sledding Day. And so they're going to have some other activities planned. What we're asking is for families to come out. They're encouraged to bring a picnic lunch to enjoy the concert and activities, to make it basically a family fun day in the sun, if you will.
Will there be any concessions available, or if people need to bring water, they need to bring a cooler with everything?
They're gonna want to bring a cooler.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. How about the Houston Pride Band? I mean, they say that going way back to 1978, back when I think there was a time when I was just trying to listen to some Bee Gees records on the radio and trying to get my own formulations with music. It started out as the Montrose Marching Band, I do believe.
Yeah, we're talking about just a small group of friends getting together pretty much to practice their horns, and it began to slowly evolve to the present day iteration that it's in. And so with that said, we're ready to celebrate our 30th anniversary, if you can believe that, 30 years of the...
Wow, that's quite a time. And from what I know in the history, it seems that they've been through some ups and downs as far as, the size. You know, the AIDS epidemic came in the 80s, and it seemed to have wiped out half the membership, and it grows back. And it's been up through a few hills. Anything that you know about that you'd like to share?
Well, you know, there are a few members in the band who have been there quite a while, and they do concur with the whole AIDS epidemic and how it wiped out half the band. And it's a very sad time for the band, and we're going to have some memoriam, if you will, during the concert, just to let people know that who's passed on that used to be part of the band.
Yeah, what's the current size of the band right now?
We're looking at about 30 members right now, so it's grown quite a bit.
And you're playing the clarinet, it says.
Yeah.
Okay, any solos?
No, I am not. Unfortunately, I am not solo quality. I'm a good player, but I'm not solo quality. Mind you, we accept all members of all playing skills, so, you know, the fact that I am not solo quality doesn't impact them at all.
And, you know, I think if no one's ever listened to this program before, do you have to be gay to be a part of the Houston Pride Band?
Absolutely not.
Okay, they accept the GLBT friendly as well, which is always nice.
Oh, yeah.
And I was going to, speaking about a little bit about the membership there, how does one go about getting involved?
Well, we have rehearsals Wednesday night. over at Resurrection Metropolitan Community Church, and anybody's invited to come and listen in. It's at 7:30 every Wednesday night, 7:30. Come in, listen to the band, or you can go to www.houstonprideband.org, or you can call 713-862-9491 and find out more information about the band.
Okay, and that's over at the 2025 West 11th Street?
Yes.
Okay. And one of the things, the rehearsals are usually from what time?
Usually from, begin around 7:30 and up until about 9:30, and then we have a little social hour afterwards, going out for dinner, if you will.
Okay. Everyone's table for 30, is what you say, huh?
Well, we've been there, yeah.
I imagine cafeterias are pretty popular there.
Yeah.
How about coming up for some of these events? I mean, what about this, the Pride Band, for when do they turn 30?
Well, we are holding our 30th anniversary concert on June 27th, and that's going to be at Zilka Hall at the Hobby Center for the Performing Arts. So it's going to be a really spectacular concert with memoriams and memories and visuals to take people down, you know, memory road.
Yeah, it's been a long 30 years. That would be very fun to see.
Yeah.
What about as far as tickets for that? It says, where can we go online to find out about those tickets?
Well, in the past, we've sold tickets through the band, but this is going to be a little different this time since we're working with the Hobby Center, and it's going to be available, ticket information, through the Hobby Center ticket office, or you can go online at thehobbycenter.org.
That sounds like big time, baby.
Yeah. We did the whole walkthrough and everything, and we're making sure everything's set up and ready to go.
You know, and I want to say that I was reading that they first performed for the public, you know, somewhere in the mid, I think in the mid-90s. I can't remember. I was reading a little bit about the history there. So that's quite some steps.
Yeah, like when they first began, it was more of a social connection, if you will, and just getting together and performing on your instrument. And then slowly they began to realize that they had enough membership to take it on the road, if you will.
All right. Well, you know, and here's one of the things. I was just wondering, who all can come and participate? I mean, is it open for, you know, anybody who's been playing in the band just currently, or?
Oh, well, with regards to the 30th anniversary concert,
yes,
that's
sir.
What we're actually doing right now. We're actively searching for past members. And as you mentioned, those past members who were part of the Lone Star Symphonic Band, the Montrose Symphonic Band, or even the Montrose Marching Band, we're looking for all those past members who can come in. And we're actually having an entire reunion weekend around the concert. So it's going to be an opportunity for them to come in and participate if they want to, or they're more than welcome just to come to the concert.
Yeah, if you're out there listening and you know somebody who is a part of one of those bands, and think they might not be listening, let them know. Let's get this word spread.
Definitely. If you were in the past band and you remember Andy Mills, our conductor emeritus, he's going to be conducting the reunion band, so that's going to be a real highlight.
Great. And what do we need to do for a past member if we want to participate?
Well, you can go online to, again, www.houstonprideband.org, or you can call 713-862-9491 and get more information that way.
Okay. Let's see. The June 27th concert, it seems, is going to be the day before the Pride Parade.
Yeah, it's a whole lot of activities planned around that entire weekend. As I mentioned, the Pride Parade, of course, came before we even planned it. So, that's another way that past members can also participate. They can participate by currently getting involved with the band as it is now, or they can participate in the reunion band, or they can march with us, you know, the day after on Saturday evening in the Pride Parade.
Well, that's going to be a big weekend for you guys.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun.
How about, what else would you like to say out there and get out there to the listeners?
Well, what I want everybody to remember is that we have a free children's concert coming up on Saturday, April 12th at 1 p.m. at Spots Park, and that we're actively searching for past members to be part of our 30th anniversary reunion weekend. You can find out more at www.houstonprideband.org.
And anything else?
I'll be back.
Okay, yeah. We appreciate you coming in, Rudy, and I look forward to hearing you guys play, and we're going out with a bit more of music.
90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew. Now, Joan, I bet you didn't realize that you were live in our studio here just a few minutes ago.
Oh, I was. What was I doing?
You were interviewing James T. Sears. Do you remember that interview from 2001?
Oh, yes. That was a wonderful. That was for Rebels, Ruby Fruit, and something else.
Rhinestones.
Rhinestones, that's right. That was the very first book in his series.
Right, yeah. Yeah, you're right. It was a very good interview.
Mm-hmm.
We pulled it out of the archives, and I promised that you would be back, and so here you are. Is there anything left up there with all the storms and tornadoes?
Actually, we didn't have that bad of weather today, so there's still some of the like bigger snow piles are still kind of clinging, but that's about it. And we've been having really nice weather. We had a beautiful weekend, so finally, winter's loosening its grip.
Okay. Well, you've got 20 minutes. Take her away.
All right. I have Jessica Valenti on the line. Jessica is the author of Full Frontal Feminism. Hi, Jessica.
Hi. How are you?
I'm great. Well, first of all, I wanted to talk to you. What kind of caught me about your book was you're kind of talking about the fact that a lot of young girls today really don't identify as feminists, even though they're reaping quite a few benefits from the feminist movement. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, I think that the idea is that we know a lot of these young women who express feminist ideals and who have feminist values, but are really afraid to use the word and to identify as a feminist because of all of the, you know, kind of ridiculous, antiquated, anti-feminist myths that are out there.
And I wanted to talk to you about that because I was talking to some friends of mine, and it almost seems like, in some ways, we're kind of going backward in time as far as women's rights and women's issues to the point that, you know, some of the, and when I say younger women, I'm 44, so I'm thinking women that are maybe 30 and under is my take on it. Almost
sure.
Are saying they don't even want to be associated with that and kind of have a negative connotation toward it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that the conservative movement has been very successful in, you know, really denigrating feminism far and wide, so that when young women think about the word feminist, you know, it's only negative connotations that come to mind. But I really do think that most young women are feminists. They just don't quite know it yet, and that's really what the book is trying to do, is, you know, dispel all of those anti-feminist myths, let young women know what feminism is really about, because I do think that if young women were exposed to the truth about feminism, they'd be much more likely to be involved.
And what are some of the suggestions you've made throughout the book for what we can do, and, you know, as older women, to kind of mentor younger women?
I think talking to younger women rather than at them, and that's not to say that older feminists only do that, but I think that, you know, there's this tendency to just to kind of paint younger women with a broad brush and say, well, they're politically apathetic and they're not interested. Instead, I really think that it's important that we kind of meet younger women where they're at, ask them about what they're interested in, and find the inroads that way to talk to them about feminism.
And I think that's a good plan, too, because even within the gay rights movement, I mean, these are the individuals that you hope someday are going to be carrying the activist torch for you.
Exactly.
So if you just kind of ignore them, blow them off, or dismiss them, in the end, you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot.
Exactly. It's really necessary that we bring younger women in now. And, you know, not just women under 30, but women who are in middle school and junior high school and high school women. You know, feminism has the potential to affect them all.
Right. And I was thinking about that because when I was in school in the 70s, I mean, it was, you know, I look back now and it was just almost like a joke. I mean, I walked into high school in 1978, and the teacher put me immediately on this business track to become a secretary. And my parents had to actually go to the school and go, my daughter's going to college.
Right.
You know, so
that's, you know, unbelievable. And, you know, I wouldn't even say that.
And it's, I don't think, I would hope nobody really has to deal with that now.
I don't think to that extreme, but I mean, not so far off, I'd say. I mean, you know, now we have things like virginity pledges and purity balls and all sorts of other ways to kind of reinforce traditional gender roles for women.
I know there was even that one, and I realize it is a religious school, but they actually offer a class in, like, housewife or something like that, and it is
yes,
for women only.
Yes, and we posted thinking, about that on feministthing.com.
Yeah, a four-year degree in housewife, that, yeah, that's really something that's going to help you along. And the thing is, the skills that are taught, some of the skills that are taught are valuable. You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, first aid, child rearing, etc. But these are also things I would think that males could profit from as well. Because the last time I checked, you know, men's food doesn't cook itself, their houses don't clean themselves, and they also do parent children.
Absolutely. But, of course, the idea behind a program like that is that, you know, women's place is in the home. And that's really what the whole program was trying to push, is, you know, getting women back in the kitchen and saying that that was, you know, women's appropriate place.
And how do we deal with that? Because along with this attitude, you know, the fact that there are young women out there today that don't even want to, you know, it's almost like the word liberal has become a dirty word, and it's kind of the same thing with feminists. And how do we convince these women that there's nothing wrong with saying, yes, I believe in equal pay for equal work. Yes, I believe in having control over my own body and my own sexuality. You know, how do we handle that? Because there is also, as you know, probably have experienced, this huge backlash. I mean, a couple months ago when the study came out that said women were still making 77 cents on the dollar for every dollar men made, some of the blogs, I mean, some of the nonsense that was coming out of people was really scary, just this vitriol and anger from these men, like, oh, you women want everything, and what's your problem? And it's like, you would think equal pay for equal work would be kind of a non-issue.
Yeah, well, you know, now, I mean, I think part of the backlash, and this is really problematic, is that there's a lot of anti-feminist women who are out there kind of perpetuating this stuff as well. I know the study that you're talking about, it when that came out, you know, organizations like the Independent Women's Forum, which is an anti-feminist organization, came out and said, oh, well, women make less money to men's dollar because we choose to take time off to take care of children, or because women work part-time schedules, and kind of like threw out all of this statistical nonsense to defend the pay gap. So it is really difficult. But I think that younger women are willing to say things like, I believe in equal pay for equal work, or I, you know, want to fight against violence against women. I think when it comes to the issues, they're willing to support them. It's that word feminist that really seems to get them.
And the other thing I wanted to say is this election, the Democratic primary, you know, this thing about young women in particular being apathetic, I have mm-hmm. seen exactly the opposite. I've seen people mobilize both for Clinton and Obama. I've seen actually, if anything, more interest from younger people and talking about the future and, yes, women's issues, you know, whether they're calling it feminism or not. You know, these individuals are supporting Obama and supporting Clinton for these reasons. They want to see change and they want to see equality and they want to be a part of the dialogue.
Absolutely. I think that you know, it's a myth that younger women in the U.S. aren't politically engaged. I've just spent the last month traveling around to different college campuses, Women's History Month, and speaking, and I'm kind of amazed at how engaged young women are, whether it's for Obama or Hillary or just really, you know, local community issues. Younger women are involved, you know, in this incredible, incredible way, and we just don't give them enough credit.
And what can we do, again, going back to the book,
sure.
What can we do to kind of make people aware that this is what young women are actually engaged? They are out there. They do have a voice. Because I think sometimes everybody gets kind of so involved in their own thing that they're not paying attention.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, certainly the work that I've done online and some other feminist bloggers is aiming to change that and, you know, trying to give younger women who are engaged a platform to kind of show all of the amazing work that's being done right now and show that, you know, young women aren't these politically apathetic, vapid, naive women that kind of the mainstream media would like us to believe young American women are like. We started a campaign, for example, called The Real Hot 100, that is a list of 100 women across the country who are doing, you know, incredible work, whether on a community level or a state level or national work, to really combat the idea that younger women aren't involved.
And let's get back to your book. The book is called Full Frontal Feminism, which is absolutely a great title.
Thank you.
And I wanted to know a little bit about how it's been doing, because it's gotten very good reviews, I've noticed, on different blogs. And even the people who on, say, Amazon.com or whatever, who have maybe said that they didn't like it for whatever reason, they at least admitted that, yes, it was compelling, and, yes, it was something that needed to be discussed. And usually when they're saying what they didn't like is obviously they probably just have a disagreement with you politically. But,
yeah.
So what has the response been overall?
The response has been really amazing and kind of incredible overall, to tell the truth. You know, I wrote the book in a really conversational, informal tone because it was important to me that the book was accessible to kind of any woman at any level of, you know, at any level of political engagement, no matter what her education level. I wanted anyone to be able to pick up the book and read it and get something out of it. So while there was some criticism that maybe it was too informal, because so often feminism is presented as, you know, very academic and very activist-y, I think overall it's been really great, and I've heard from people who are handing the book off to their sisters, to their cousins, to their, you know, classmates, and that's really what the goal was. So I'm thrilled.
And now let's move on a little bit and talk a little bit about feministing.com. Can you tell our listeners what that is exactly?
Sure. Feministing.com is a blog that I started about 4 years ago. It is a blog written by all young women. Our readers are of all ages, but we really started it to kind of make sure that younger women who are interested in feminism had a forum to talk about their issues, because I had worked in the mainstream feminist movement for a while, and I felt like younger women's voices weren't necessarily being heard or taken seriously. And I wanted to create a space online where we could do that.
And how much of what you created through feministing.com kind of led to or, you know, enabled Full Frontal Feminism?
Yeah, I think it was all of feministing.com. It definitely led right directly to it. I mean, kind of the way the book came about was we started getting a lot of emails from younger women who stumbled upon the site by doing, you know, a Google search for something else and found the site accidentally. And these were all younger women, teenagers, who bought into all of the anti-feminist myths. You know, we would get emails from girls saying, I thought feminists were supposed to be man-haters, and I didn't realize that young women were feminists, or I thought feminists, you know, were supposed to be hairy, and all this kind of, you know, silly stuff. And that's when I kind of realized, like, wow, these myths are much more pervasive than I really thought, and there really needs to be a book out there to combat that and can speak to younger women, you know, where they're at. So it was a complete result of the work that's being done on the site.
And what kind of was your driving force when you started feministing.com? Did you have this plan in mind that this was going to be kind of a place where younger women could go to learn about feminism? Or did it just kind of start as your personal blog and then evolve from there? What was the game plan?
You know, there wasn't much of a game plan, to tell the truth. I didn't really, I wasn't that involved in the blogosphere before I started feministing. I didn't know that much about it. I had a friend who had a blog. And I started it with a couple of other younger women I was working with at the time, when I was with a national women's organization and I was feeling kind of disgruntled and not as idealistic as I used to be. So we just wanted to create a space where younger women could talk about feminism, not necessarily, you know, learn about feminism. We didn't want to have one kind of monolithic platform about what feminism was. We just wanted it to be a sounding board of sorts. And I think that, you know, at the time when I started it 4 years ago, there wasn't all that much there online in terms of young feminism, or at least there wasn't that much in terms of, you know, stuff that was easily findable. So I think in some way we ended up filling a gap, because there was a ton of feminist activism being done on the ground, obviously. It just wasn't necessarily being represented online.
And did you think you were going to get the kind of response that you ultimately ended up getting?
No, you know, we really didn't. I mean, it's been much better than we ever could have expected, and I really credit that to the amazing roster of writers that we have. that, you know, I've met throughout the years and kind of brought on, and we have a really great bunch of women who have all different kinds of opinions, and I think that's really what attracts people to the site, is that we don't have a kind of a standard press release response to every issue that comes out, that sometimes we disagree publicly on the site. It really is a place for discourse, which I think a lot of younger women are looking for.
And where do you hope to see this kind of go in the future?
I hope to see it go a lot of places. We're actually working on a redesign of the site right now to make it more community-oriented so that anyone can start their own blog on feministing, so that it can be a little bit more of an action hub. So we'd like to expand it as much as we possibly can and kind of move with the technology as the technology goes. And hopefully, you know, one day make it into a nonprofit so that I can pay my very hardworking writers who all have full-time jobs other than writing for the site.
And where can people, well, first of all, how can people access feministing.com? And then how can people get a copy of Full Frontal Feminism?
To go to feministing.com, all they have to do is go to the site. It's feministing.com, just like verbing the noun. And to get a copy of Full Frontal Feminism, it actually should be in most chain and local bookstores, but if not, they can order it on Amazon or Powell's.com.
Great. Well, Jessica, I want to thank you so much for being with us tonight. We've been talking to Jessica Valenti. She is the author of Full Frontal Feminism and also runs a site called feministing.com. Jessica, I want to thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you so
much. You're listening to KPFT Houston.
I need a witness to save my soul. I need a savior to make me whole. I need the truth that I'll never know. And then I climb into the attic I used to dream. This is a fool boy in the make-believe. And with these tricks lying up my sleeve. And the whole wide world lies at my feet. And now, in the morning sun, use your arms to uplift each other.
Must be the
must be the way they lean on him. Tell me, why do I always fall in love with a bartender, bartender? Some kind of charm coming from behind the bar. Is that the bartender, bartender?
That was Eric Hyman from his 2000 CD called Everywhere All at Once and Bartender. And before that, Tom Goss from his 2008 EP Rise and a song called Morning Sun. Both of those gentlemen, Tom Goss and Eric Hyman, will be at Guava Lamp, Thursday, April 3rd. And Guava Lamp is located at 570 Waugh Drive. If you want more information, send email to info@guavalamphouston.com. And again, that's this coming Thursday, April 3rd, that Tom Goss and Eric Hyman will be there.
Mark your calendars. Amy Goodman is coming to Houston. The host of Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman, will be live in Houston on Thursday, April 17th.
Amy will speak about her new book,
Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times.
The event will be held at the Pavilion Royale Event Center in a fundraiser benefiting KPFT.
Tickets to the event are $15 pre-sale, $20 at the door. In addition, you can get preferred seating to the event, a copy of Amy Goodman's new book, and a ticket to the exclusive reception with Amy for $250.
Folk music performer David Massengill opens the event at 6:30. Amy Goodman will speak at 7:30.
Again, Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, comes to Houston for a live speaking engagement on Thursday, April 17th.
The Pavilion Royale is wheelchair accessible and is located at 5800 Airline Drive.
This is Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
This is Queer Voices.
Can some straights go free by building bridges? The answer to that musical question later in the program.
Here come the lesbians, here come the leaping lesbians. We're gonna please and tease you, hypnotize and tight and squeeze you. We're gonna get you if we can.
Here come the lesbians.
Don't go and try to fight it, run away or try to hide it. We want your love and that's our plan.
Here come the lesbians.
Don't look in the closet. From floors and ceilings, you can't escape, you're in our hands.
Here come the lesbians.
Inside your heart is racing when you see our shadows chasing. Here come the lesbians.
Here come the lesbians.
Here come the lesbians.
Here come the lesbians.
The leaping lesbians.
Sue Fink's live performance of Leaping Lesbians was featured on the landmark Olivia Records compilation album Lesbian Concentrate. That classic collection came out in dubious honor of Florida Orange Juice pitch woman Anita Bryant's anti-queer initiative campaign in 1977. But Olivia and women's music had already been making herstory for 4 years by then. This Way Out correspondent Elaine Meislisch continues her conversation with Olivia president and original collective member Judy DeLugach about the evolution of the record label into a lesbian cruise and vacation company.
We were really paralleling the beginning of this movement for, mm-hmm. for women.
Yes.
That we just happened serendipitously, things happen this way so often, where we were just in the right place at the right time. It started out, you know, there would be, when Meg went on the road around the country, she'd go to church basements and, you know, women's centers, mm-hmm. and there'd be 50 people at a concert. And that would be in 1974. By 1975, we were doing major halls throughout the country. And then we did the distribution ourselves.
Uh-huh.
So we helped produce a concert in, let's say, Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
And then Meg or Chris or Teresa or Linda Tillery, whoever we was recording, we would come there and we'd say, hey, would anyone like to be a distributor? And so a fan from the audience, if you'd like to be a distributor, come back and see us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we taught women how to distribute records, and they were like, the really, you know, strong, dynamic fans of the music,
right.
became the distributors.
And then there were, and then the festivals.
And then the festivals started to happen.
Yeah.
So it all just began amazing. To boom and really changed so many people's lives. It
changed my life.
After doing this for 35 years, I have a pretty good idea that it was a pretty amazing thing to have happened. It wasn't easy economically, even though we were so amazingly successful mm-hmm. in terms of what we were trying to do. The economics weren't easy because as a record company, you had a consignment business,
mm-hmm.
and that meant that you never knew when the money was coming, if it was coming in. And we really spent a lot of money on the production of the albums because we wanted them to sound as good as anything else out there. We wanted women to be incredibly proud of the level of quality that we could create. But what we didn't realize was that not every artist was going to sell as well as Meg's album sold or Chris's album sold. You know, the first album Meg did sold 75,000 copies. But, you know, the second
album
I
Know You Know?
I Know You Know, uh-huh. yeah. The second album we did was Chris Williamson. It sold over
mm-hmm.
a third of a million. It was The Changer and the Change.
Changer and the Change, yeah.
And it sold over a third of a million copies. It was outrageous
mm-hmm.
what happened.
Yeah.
If you sold 30,000 copies of something or 20,000, that was extraordinary for an independent company, but we didn't make that many albums in
mm-hmm.
a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we couldn't. We were a small group, so the economics were always hard.
How did you then transition into doing cruises and vacations?
After 15 years, I went, you know, I'd done this for a long time, and all of the other collective members had already left.
Mm.
We did our 10th anniversary at Carnegie Hall.
Mm-hmm.
We had 5,600 women at that concert from all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became our 15th anniversary, and I said, you know, I think it's time to maybe do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And we did this series of 15th anniversary concerts. And at the first one, which was in Seattle, a woman said after the concert, God, this concert was so great. Wouldn't it be great to have a concert on the water, meaning like around the bay?
Around the bay.
And I went, concert on the water, a cruise vacations, vacations for women. I can do that. I knew that it would be an absolute success because I had been out my entire adult life except when Rachel and I went on vacation.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd have to be in the closet. You mm-hmm. couldn't hold hands on the beach. You wouldn't kiss. You couldn't go out dancing unless you found a gay bar.
Mm-hmm.
So I went out and I chartered our first ship
mm-hmm.
and said, wrote a letter to the Olivia Records mailing list and said, I think you'd like to go on vacation and be able to be free to be yourself. And so I just chartered a ship and you have to sign up and within the next 3 months.
So you chartered the whole ship?
Yes. Mm-hmm. You have to... send all your money now. You can't cancel. It's a year from now, and it's mm-hmm. 4 nights in the Bahamas, and you want to come, and 600 women signed up almost immediately.
Uh-huh.
I said, oh, let's do that again. And 600 more women signed up.
That's from right. all over the world.
And now we take about 10,000 people a year
oh.
on trips. We've done, I mean, we've taken well over 100,000 women on vacation mm-hmm. all over the world.
Yeah.
That need to have a space where you see, you know, I may be out my entire life, but when you come on an Olivia trip, and you never have to think about anything for an entire week.
Yes.
Including being a lesbian, including how to act with your partner, including, you know, being in a space where you're just, everyone here is one. No one's other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this is all about.
And how can people find out about Olivia?
Well, they can go to olivia.com. The other way is to call us
mm-hmm.
at 1-800-631-6277.
Mm-hmm.
And we will help you make some great decisions about where to go. We have wonderful, wonderful people working at Olivia who just believe in the vision and the mission.
Let's all sing together and accent every note. Unless we all join hands, how else can the sisterhood stay afloat? Well, some people think Sappho was a little touch. I just think Sappho loved that touch. We all love so much. And we're a woman loving women, but then we're all too much.
That was Teresa Troa and friends singing Woman Loving Women from her The Ways a Woman Can Be album on Olivia Records. Co-founder and president Judy Dlugacz charted Olivia's journey with Elaine Meislish.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
The city of Chicago rules for a while, but a sassy sister also has her say in this edition of The Audiophile.
The fourth album by Chicago artist Scott Free is very gay and very political. Hi, I'm J.D. Doyle.
I'm Chris Wilson, and you're listening to Audiophile. And Scott Free's CD has the intriguing name, The Pink Album, a pop opera.
I was beaten up every day, holding my hands like a girl. I was punched in the school hallway, sharing my books like a girl. And this fire and hate chased me, tripped me, laughing because I ran like a girl.
Scott's album covers a lot of musical styles and a lot of ground lyrically.
The album is actually a concept album about
growing up gay, coming out stories, coming of age, gay rights, the AIDS era, and modern issues like gay parenting. There are stories from friends, ex-lovers, and acquaintances that take you from the mid-60s and 70s all the way up to today.
In my pursuit of happiness, I live with one life in the next. I made it easy for the rest. I suffered while they were waiting for a wife. Inside is cut me like a knife. But I don't care, now it's my life. It matters. I was doing just what they wanted. But not tonight, meet Mr. Right.
Find out more about Scott Free and the Pink Album, a pop opera, at www.scottfree.net.
I need easy kisses tonight. Don't want a lover who wants to fight for me in my place. I ain't playing no games tonight, 'cause I don't want you that way. Give me something so sweet, tender just for me. But don't bring me no hard love, baby. Make it easy.
Also out of Chicago is the band Devin and the Straits. And their name means just what you think it does, while their music gives you their brand of classic country.
What we tried to do with the new album is to capture the charm and the soul of our live show while giving it a slightly different feel. So the sound is a mixture of the classic country I grew up on, mixed with a little bit of the blues background from some of the other band members. Also, some of the more heartbreaking songs have our version of a bluegrass feel to them.
Well, it was cowboy night at the town hall, but everyone was getting high. We were three songs in when the crowd went numb. Somebody was making googly eyes. Well, I turned to my left, turned to my right, see where the gaze did land. Boy, it's the devil that called me out, but you've been heaven sent. You may fall in love.
When it's cowboy night at the town hall.
The name of the album and the band is Devin and the Straits, and you'll find them at www.devinandthestraits.com.
Sister is the sassy title of the new album by Alicia Bridges, which shows a variety of musical styles you may not have expected, and also brings back a classic.
Say It Sister is about love, and sometimes about heartache and infidelity. It's about the blues, it's about rock and roll, and of course we have I Love the Nightlife, which is definitely about partying and the disco.
Find out more about the CD Say It Sister by Alicia Bridges at www.aliciabridges.com.
That's it for this edition of Audiophile. You can write to us at our new address, 594 Sawdust Road, number 273, Spring, Texas, 877-380 or by visiting our website at www.audiofile.org. That's www.audiofile.org.
Audiofile is produced by Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trentum. I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm J.D. Doyle. Keep listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Erica Springer, Rex Watner with Bill Kelly, Elaine Meislish, and Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trentum contributed program material. Thanks also to J.D. Doyle, Mark Manning, and Jamie Rich. Sue Fink, Teresa Troll, Scott Free, Devin and the Straits, and Alicia Bridges performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Listen online to This Way Out exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also click on the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air. Email us at tworadio@aol.com or write to P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, 7LTN Launceston, Tasmania, WREK Atlanta, Georgia, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
So don't bother to undress.
That was Phil Dutra, and that was from his 2007 EP, Right Behind the Rain. And before that, Horse, Can't Break My Heart, from her 2007 CD, Red Haired Girl. This is Queer Voices. And now again from the Queer Voices archives, from This Way Out, a segment from March of 2002. This is an interview with Peter Dell, a humorist.
And finally this week, Peter Dell recalls a childhood brush with handwriting analysis that revealed a bit more than he wanted to know in Peter's Peas.
Everyone thought that Jamie Osich was gay. Jamie was effeminate naturally, something about the way he laughed, all high and girly, or the way he moved across a room like he was floating. All I know is that I hung around Jamie Osich because I always secretly hoped he would tell me he liked boys, because I would have told him then that I liked boys too. So we were in the library finishing up a project for some history class, or English class, or something. We finished early and we were both bored. I looked over at his Spanish homework. He had that big, loopy, very neat handwriting that only girls had, all soft and flowery and feminine. The only way it could have been any more queenie is if he had used little hearts to dot his I's. "You write like a girl," I told him. "Shut up," he said. "Let's go check it out," I said. "There's got to be a book in here about handwriting." We hunted the card catalog. Under the handwriting analysis subject cards, we came across several titles, all in the same Dewey Decimal neighborhood. I handed a book to Jamie and told him to find a sample of what his handwriting looked like while I searched another book. "Here," I said, "you do your B's like that. See there on your homework. Your B there and there and there. And it says, often associated with artists and dancers." "I guess that is my B," he said. I gloated. Then I saw it. The quintessential Peter Dell letter. The letter I had written differently from everyone else since I had first learned cursive. It was the lowercase Peter Dell P, the one with the high first stroke, so the letter had a cap on it. I damn near had a trademark on this P, and here it was in a handwriting analysis book. I was ecstatic. So ecstatic that I didn't read the caption. "Jamie, look, this is my P. I always do my P's this way. This is crazy. I've never seen anyone else do their P's like this." He took the book. Then Jamie laughed. It was one of those deep belly laughs. I immediately knew I was in trouble. I guess that is your pee, Peter, Jamie said between chuckles. I spun the book around. The caption read, "This example of the letter P is very common in men with homosexual tendencies." A gay P. A queer P. A faggot P. The English homework sitting on the table next to the book, my English homework, was littered with the gay P. Every word started with P now as I read my paper. One word with two P's in it. Each percussive principal consonant presumed that Peter was positively a pansy. I blushed a deep, angry red. "That book," I stumbled, it's old. That it doesn't mean any. It's all fake. I mean, really. Jamie just laughed. "How about this?" Jamie finally managed as his chortling died down. "Let's agree that you can't judge people on their handwriting. I don't have a girl's handwriting. There is no such thing. Just like you don't have a gay man's handwriting. Agreed?" I nodded my head furiously in agreement. The next day, I turned in my English assignment. The lowercase cursive P's on the paper I turned in were new to me, a foreign stroke with my pen. Generic little line with a half circle attached. To this day, my hand doesn't remember how to make that first P, that beautiful little twist of my wrist, which set me apart from Jamie Oach. And sometimes I want my P back, my charming, unique P, which was once very common in this man with homosexual tendencies.
Peter's Peas, written and read by Peter Dell and produced by John Beaufre and Steve Pride.
And again, that was from the Queer Voices Archive, to which you are currently listening live.
Well, next week we're going to have David Elliott on, giving us an update on what's going on in politics. And we had the county and state Senate district conventions happening over the weekend, and read about some of it, which was rather interesting. Some of it went somewhat smoothly. Some of it, you know, went till the middle of the night. But, you know, we just keep on with this stuff with politics. And in fact, we have an election going on right now. There's a runoff going. Early voting started today. It goes through Friday from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Election day is a week from tomorrow, Tuesday. If you'd like some more information, go to caucus.org, and you can find out what's going on there. Definitely want to thank all of those people who pledged to our radio show and KPFT in general. We did meet our goal on the station in general. In fact, we went over a little bit, but that all depends on all those people who fulfilled those pledges. So we really, really appreciate that. Coming up, one of the things I'm going to plan on doing is sort of doing a State of the Community roundtable discussion, and I'll get together with Deborah and talk about when we can schedule that. Other than that, you know, if you're interested in coming on the show, your group, or if you have something you'd really like to talk to us about, you can email me, jack@queervoices.org.
Well, on the show this evening, we had Rudolph Martinez from the Houston Pride Band, James T. Sears, author of Queer Issues in the South, and Jessica Valenti, author of Full Frontal Feminism. On the show next week, of course, we have News Wrap from This Way Out, and Jack mentioned that we have David Elliott from Washington, D.C. We will also have Tony Pryor and Curtis Bell talking about their workshop for improving public speaking through, are you ready for this? Singing. Improving public speaking through singing. Well, okay, that's going to be pretty interesting, so tune in for that next week at 8 o'clock. Have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Mark your calendars. Amy Goodman is coming to Houston. The host of Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman, will be live in Houston on Thursday, April 17th.
Amy will speak about her new book,
Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times.
The event will be held at the Pavilion Royale Event Center in a fundraiser benefiting KPFT.
Tickets to the event are $15 pre-sale, $20 at the door. In addition, you can get preferred seating to the event, a copy of Amy Goodman's new book, and a ticket to the exclusive reception with Amy for $250.
Folk music performer David Massengill opens the event at 6:30. Amy Goodman will speak at 7:30.
Again, Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, comes to Houston for a live speaking engagement on Thursday, April 17th.
The Pavilion Royale is wheelchair accessible and is located at 5800 Airline Drive.
This is Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
Pacifica Radio, KPFT, broadcasts Houston's most vibrant, unique, interactive, and sometimes controversial radio 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, but catching it all can be tough. But there's a hope. We now have the best of KPFT podcasts on iTunes and other services.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.